This is the Jason Jones Show, powered by Mudhouse Media. Now, here's Jason Jones.
Aloha, everybody, and welcome to the Jason Jones Show. I am your host, Jason Jones, broadcasting from the beautiful Waikiki Beach. And today, my interview, as we continue the 49 days in a row of Roe, and my interview today is with Father Frank Pavone, National Director of Priests for Life, President of the National Pro-Life Religious Council, and Pastoral Director of Rachel's Vineyard. Father Frank Pavone is one of the most prominent pro-life leaders in the world. He has been my friend and cohort for over two decades, and today we will be talking to Father Frank about the world before Roe, during Roe, and after Roe. As he says, the Supreme Court has opened the door. Now it is our choice. Are we going to walk through it toward a culture of life, or will we allow the door to be slammed shut, or even worse, will we walk through that door into a culture of death? This episode is being brought to you by the Vulnerable People Project, standing in solidarity with the most vulnerable people in the world, from children in Chinese-occupied East Turkestan, children and families in Chinese-occupied East Turkestan, in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, to our shelters in Western Ukraine. Go to thegreatcampaign.org, become a monthly donor, and you will be standing shoulder to shoulder with us as we serve the vulnerable. This episode is also being brought to you by the great MyPillow. Go to MyPillow.com, use the code Jones, and to celebrate Roe's overturning, make them angry and buy a pillow. They don't like Mike Lindell because Mike Lindell stands for life. So we should celebrate by just go get yourself a pillow. There's no better way to celebrate. Go to MyPillow.com, use the code Jones, get yourself a pillow. And of course, the first thing you should do every morning is read the Epoch Times, read Epic Times. Go to iReadEpoch.com, use the code Jason Jones, and you get the best price on not only the digital subscription, which you need that, right? Because you need to share it with folks on the social media, but you need the print edition so you can give it to your friends, your family, your neighbors. Do it like I do. Read it with the children. That's iReadEpoch.com, code Jason Jones. So here we go. I did this show for our posterity. I hope 100 years from now, activists battling against AI and transhumanism look to the pro-life movement the way we looked to the civil rights movement and the abolitionists for motivation. That's why I did this show. So you get to listen to it now, but I made this for people listening to it 100 years from now. Here we go. Father Frank Pavone. It's the Jason Jones Show. Father Frank Pavone, welcome to the Jason Jones Show.
Joy to be with you. How you doing?
I'm doing great, Father. How are you doing?
I'm pinching myself. And I've been doing so for almost a week. This is incredible. Jason, you and I have been looking forward to this day for decades.
I remember when
now it's here.
I remember, Father Frank. I mean, I've been working with you now for over 20 years. And in 2000, yes. You don't remember this, but I remember this because I was an activist. You're in Waikiki with me right now, Father, by the way. You know, I was an activist in college and in the Army in Hawaii, and I moved to D.C. in 2000, and we had met once or twice. But I was walking across the street at the March for Life, and you waved at me, and you said, "Hi, Jason." And I said, "Father Frank Pavone knows my name." I was excited about that. I was excited about that.
Oh, yes, indeed. Well, I was very excited to have met you, and, you know, we had some great conversations. And I saw what we need is passion in this movement. You know, a lot of people have the right idea about abortion. A lot of people agree. But what I saw in you, and of course you've sustained it to this day, is just that zeal, that passion. That's what makes the difference. The courage, passion, zeal. That's what makes the difference between those who change history and those who simply have an idea of where it should go.
Well, Father, I'm doing 49 days in a row, R-O-E, on Roe v. Wade. I want to catalog, in the wake of this great decision, America before, during, and after Roe v. Wade. Because for me, I feel like Forrest Gump, that since 1989, I got to work with and around heroes like you. And I want people to remember the millions and millions of men and women who courageously fought from the early 70s, even the 60s with Father Marx, Father Paul Marx and others, who paved the way for this great decision for America, for the court to get a president like Trump. By the way, I want to thank you for early on courageously advocating for Trump before I was, I have to say. I was skeptical. Maybe before we get to the rest of the interview, how did you know to trust? Because, you know, if not for you and Alveda King and a handful of others, how did you know to trust this guy?
You know, I think, of course, I'm from New York originally. We grew up just north of New York City. We would be, you know, hearing about Trump all the time. And I knew he was the kind of a guy, first of all, who got things done, knew how to get things done. And very often in a position like that of being president, you know, knowing how to get things done is just as important as knowing what things to get done, because you can rely on a lot of smart advisors. And he always knew in his business work how to surround himself with smart people. And they could point the direction, you know, that you have to go. But to be able to get it done, I think, is a quality that he brings, that he brought to the presidency, that he brings to whatever he does. And that makes all the difference, you know. And he often gives examples of that in his speeches, you know. Hey, you know, for many, many presidents promised to move the embassy to Jerusalem, and they didn't deliver, but I got it done. And for decades, they were trying to figure out how to do right to try for these drugs for terminally ill people. I got it done. And he was able to solve problems. And, you know, just combination of seeing that, of seeing also, you know, the idea of a non-politician getting into office. I've always thought that, you know, that can lead to, you know, the kind of change that's needed when politics becomes stale. And then there's a number of things like that led me to endorse him early on.
I think that your endorsement was decisive in Trump winning, and it was decisive in Trump, of course. Gets the credit. I mean, this would not have happened.
He does.
If Mitt Romney was president of the United States, this would not have happened.
No. This would not have happened, you know. And again, you know, a lot of it was, of course, history was on his side, Jason, as you know. I mean, nobody could have foreseen when Ruth Bader Ginsburg would die. And there it was right before the election. And it wasn't only that history was on his side. It was that when history unfolded, again, he jumped at the opportunity. And when you had, for example, the horrific opposition to Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation, President Trump didn't abandon him. He stood with him. He didn't withdraw the nomination. He stood with him. And he got it done. He knows how to fight. And that's between that and the historical circumstances that were only the hand of God, he does deserve the credit for this.
So, Father, really the reason I'm doing this 49 shows in a row every day is for our posterity. I have visions of a PhD, doctoral, so some guy working on his dissertation 100 years from now, combing through these audits. What do you want our posterity to know about the last 49 years in the struggle to protect the most vulnerable members of our family, the human family? And, you know, if you're listening to this 100 years from now, you might be around because of this decision. You might be around. What would you want them to know about the struggle to defend life in this country, which has not ended? I say this isn't Normandy. This is Dunkirk. This is the very beginning of our campaign in toward, you know, St. John Paul the Great asked us to mobilize and launch a great campaign in defense of life. And I see this as the first milestone as we walk into a culture of life so we can leave our posterity a civilization of love. What would you want our posterity to know about this struggle, what has been going on for the past, since you were 12, 13 years old? I think you were 13, yeah. Father, when Roe v. Wade, were you 13?
Yeah, that's right. In 76, yeah. Wait a minute now. I was born in 59, so...
73, so you'd have been...
I was 17.
17, okay.
One of the things is, as we've lived through these last 50 years, we knew it was historic. I mean, we would often say within the movement, and then we still do, you know, hey, you know, this is like, you know, living at the time of, you know, slavery or the Holocaust, you know, and we would make the comparisons, you know, what would we have done if we were in those circumstances? And then we would translate it, well, then that's what we have to do now. And there was a deep awareness, there is a deep awareness that we're living in a historic moment. And the other thing I think for people in posterity to realize is, you know, they will encounter moments like this too, and they shouldn't be surprised if, you know, a lot of it is normal. What I mean is, when you think about, wow, you know, what was it like for the people that lived during the Holocaust, and the trains were going by, and they knew what was going on, and, you know, well, what was it like? I mean, a lot of the time, they were just trying to live their lives day by day and make sure they had, you know, enough food to eat and shelter and do whatever, caring for their family and doing the work that they did. And it, you know, sometimes it's easy to miss an historical moment of great significance.
That's really profound, Father.
Uh-huh.
For most of them, yeah. What was it like? It was like, I got to get my kids ready and packed off for school. I have to grab my tool belt and yep. head to the coal mine. I got work to do.
Right.
It was life.
That's right. It was life.
Very
profound. There's always life. People are always living their life. But you know, you just pause for a moment and say, what is going on right now? Wow. This like gets to the root of everything, of whether we're going to protect life or take life. That's it. That's the hinge of everything else.
Yeah. I would often ask myself, Father, and I love the way you put that. Do I believe that abortion is the destruction of the child in the womb? Do I think it's the taking of innocent human life? Am I behaving as someone who believes that? And I mean, I will tell you, since my child was aborted, I woke up every day to order my life to defend the child in the womb from violence. But did I work with zeal and passion 20-hour days, 7 days? Of course not, because life is going on. And so you're right. It's all of us have become numb by the culture of death, and we just live our life, and life is life, regardless of the horrors that are going on around you.
Yes, and many who are living their lives, you know, are very passionate about this, very aware of it. But we have to always bring ourselves back to the sources of getting aware of it. So, you know, whether it's the pictures of abortion or the testimonies of those who've been wounded by it, or just always going back to the basics, because we can so easily be lulled to sleep. And many are asleep. Maybe an event like this, the reversal of Roe, so such a monumental event, wakes some people up or makes some people start paying more attention to the issue. Hopefully so. But a lot of people, during all of these crises in human history, many people have sleepwalked through the whole thing.
You know, one thing that I hope that folks in the future get to see, which even our media doesn't let people today see, is how diverse the pro-life movement. I think it's the most diverse social movement in the history of the world. And yet, of course, you know, you're a Catholic priest, and we're told that it's just Catholics and fundamentalist Christians. And you were one of the first, you know, I was a young atheist for my first 13 years in the pro-life movement. And you have always been very kind and open to the broad, to those of us who didn't fit. Like, for example, Brian Kemper. I tell when I speak at these sort of really unique pro-life groups that have just started flourishing since they could find each other through social media. They've always been there, right? But through social media, they could find each other and have a voice. But
right.
And I'm often asked to speak to these groups, and I say there was a day when Brian Kemper, the evangelical Christian with tattoos, and Jason Jones, the blonde kid with from Hawaii who was an atheist, we were as diverse as you could see in the movement. But you have always and shown an openness and acceptance to, and I don't know if you want to talk about that, just how broad and wide-ranging the movement to defend the child in the womb has become.
Yes. Well, you know what? That was an inspiration for me from day one when I was a teenager and went to that third annual March for Life in 1976.
You were at the third annual March for Life?
That was my introduction to the pro-life movement.
Whoa. So if you got a card punch for each one, you'd had a bunch of free coffees by now.
Yeah, that's right. So, but it was the diversity that you're referring to now.
So you saw it at the 3rd March. Did you see it at the 3rd March already?
I saw the diversity there, yes. It struck me that, wow, you know, I saw some of the signs, you know, different groups, different religious groups. It wasn't just Catholic. And there were people of all ages. And I noticed the different ethnic backgrounds and even political diversity. Of course, back then, there were a lot more Democrats that were pro-life in the Congress.
The great Nat Hentoff, the Democrat liberal writer. I mean, so many great people. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. So, the diversity, you know, this shows the strength of the movement. And to me, it shows the fundamental nature of the movement. What I mean is when there's something so fundamental as you don't kill babies, you know, we protect our children, that movement comes together not because someone from a position of power, whether in the government or in the church, calls it together. No, it's arising from the human heart. It's arising around the kitchen tables of America. It's arising from the deep human felt instinct that you got to do something when children are being killed. And that's how the movement has arisen, and that's why it's so diverse. It's so diverse because it's so fundamental. The only criteria you need to be pro-life is to be alive. Because if you're alive, you can see the value of life. And this is where, you know, it has arisen in circles of religious people as well as non-religious people, people of all political backgrounds, ethnic backgrounds, all ages. And any other difference there might be between people. And I love that because it's also the nature of a coalition. If we're going to get a job done as big as this job has been of reversing Roe and as big as the work yet to be done is of actually, you know, enacting more protections, we have to be able to form coalitions. And as you know, the concept of a coalition is that you've got one focus, in our case, ending child killing, and that's the only thing you require the people that you're going to form coalition with to agree on. That's the only thing you require them to agree on. Everything else is like, come as you are, you know, be who you are. Let's work together on this. Now, once we establish that, of course, then we can have whatever interaction on other issues, and it may in fact lead people to then collaborate on other issues as you do, you know, on so many human rights issues. You know, your work is spanning the spectrum of all of life. And that is a value that we have to be proclaiming. But the pro-life movement is so diverse precisely because, again, it's focused on one very simple goal that should be just something everybody can agree on.
But what I've noticed with you, I mean, going back decades with you, Father, is, you know, I hate this, the alphabet soup, LGBTQ and all that, but there is this huge contingent that's very active and very passionate, maybe the most passionate group in the pro-life movement now, I would say, is coming from the left. And
And
so many of them will, you know, they'll say to me, you know, Father Frank Pavone stands with me in public. Father Frank Pavone smiles and loves me when he sees me. And, you know, there's this caricature they'll make of an Orthodox Catholic priest. And yet you've genuinely been open and loving and you've stood in public with people. Have you ever gotten kicked for that or?
No. I mean, I genuinely do love them. They are just fantastic people. And you know, we see eye to eye. You know, I mean, these are people who, like you say, they're very, very much on the left. Some of them very, very much into the, you know, LGBTQ plus, whatever, however many other letters they have. And you know, it's some wild stuff, and they don't believe in God, and many of them. But my goodness, if they're willing to stand up and stop the dismemberment of children, you know, they have latched on to the truth. And in that sense, they've also latched on to God, even though they may want to put it in those terms. God is the source of all truth, and no matter how people recognize it, if they adhere to it, they are in some way connecting with Him. But I just appreciate their willingness to stand for this truth. And, you know, it takes two people, too, you know, so they have to be willing to stand with folks who, you know, maybe represent a political platform that, you know, in many other ways, they don't, not just that they agree with, but they might outright oppose. But it takes a good amount of courage and integrity for them to do that as well.
Yeah, and that's what I love about the pro-life movement. The blessing, the grace of it is, I say that, you know, when you stand with Christ at the cross, all the jerks have left. You're there with Our Lady and John and Mary. You know,
yeah.
It's and so I think when you stand with the child in the womb against the spirit of the age, when you look around, you're just surrounded by the most wonderful people.
Oh, it's so true. It's so true. And people who know how to love and to care and to persevere. That's the other great thing. You know, I think when people look back at this movement, like you were saying, maybe 100 years from now, they're studying this movement. You know, they're going to be marveling at the perseverance, because there were so many times in the movement where all the political winds were against us. And nevertheless, there wasn't a day that the movement didn't keep the focus and keep looking ahead and saying, there's going to be victory someday and we're going to achieve our goal. That takes faith. It takes a great amount of strength, and it takes a great amount of focus. Like Peter, you know, don't look at the wind and the waves. Just look at the Lord and keep moving towards him. The movement has done that.
Yeah, it's like Cecile Richards said, you know, they're like gnats. You swipe them away and then more of them show up. And I've been watching all of these young people fill the media that are pro-life the past couple of weeks. Kristen Hawkins was on CNN the other day, and the poor host was just not ready. And Kristen Hawkins, it's as if we have these youth who've been trained up and ready for a fight. And it's like these guys didn't even know they were in for a fight. And they're debating, like they were the CNN host was, she just looked ridiculous in her conversation with Kristen Hawkins. And I realized the greatest thing the movement has done is it's really trained up young people to be able to go out there and take leadership roles and advocate for life in a way the other side, which has just done nothing but lie and gaslight, they did themselves a disservice. Because I know whenever I'm in anti-abortion rallies, pro-life rallies, or when I go to their events, and I'll tell the other side, you know, I believe that most of us, we have more in common. We're the people in society that are willing to risk and to be hated to stand with women. And so we have a lot in common. So I do think that on the other side, there are a lot of folks that are authentically committed to women. They really are worried that the overturning of Roe versus Wade is going to be harmful for women. But I guess what happens is when they have an honest debate, so many of them then cross over to our side and become our leaders, like Abby Johnson, right? Like once they start to be honest, they become pro-life.
Well, you know, that's why, that's one of the reasons why, aside from the constitutional issues, that this Dobbs case is such a victory. Because what it has done, it has allowed the public debate now in America an opening to really flourish. And people need to catch the significance of what's going on here. The Roe v. Wade in Planned Parenthood v. Casey, for all these 50 years, they've been saying, oh, there's a constitutional right to abortion. Now, in a courtroom or in a legislative assembly, when that sentence is said, is that there is a constitutional right to abortion, you know, it short-circuits everything. It's like, well, then why are you going to pass a law against the constitutional right? Why are you going to even have a discussion? And that's what happened with this Mississippi law. When it was first brought into court, the district court said, well, listen, we don't want to hear about fetal development. We don't want to hear about fetal pain. We don't want to hear about anything except, is this ban before viability? Well, yes, of course it is. Well, then, sorry, we don't have to go any further. It's unconstitutional. So what it does is it short circuits the debate. I think the same dynamic happens around the kitchen tables around America. People are talking about abortion, or they're maybe trying to talk about it, and then someone pipes up and says, oh, but it's a constitutional right, you know, da, da, da. And then it's like it cuts off further discussion. Like, who wants to argue against constitutional right? So what Dobbs has done now, it said, look, folks, sorry. You know, basically, we could talk more about this, too. And this decision is like an act of repentance by the Supreme Court. They are saying we were wrong. And not only are they saying we were wrong, they are saying we're not capable of fixing this or deciding this issue. Some people think that the court just imposed a national policy on abortion. The court did just the opposite. The court said we're getting out of the business of imposing a national policy on abortion, whether pro-choice or pro-life. We're not doing it. Folks, we're not qualified to do it. This is not a decision for 9 people. This is a decision for 330 million people. Work it out with your state legislatures. You're far more capable than we are. So having said that, it opens up the debate free now from the short-circuiting nature of this fake dogma. Oh, it's a constitutional right, you know? No, put that off the table and look at it, the argument on its merits. Talk about the baby. Talk about what abortion is. Talk about the mom. What does she really need? Are there better ways to help her? What are the after effects of abortion? All these key questions can now be debated more robustly. And I think that if we allow this moment to inform our, you know, whether it's conversation between two friends or a conversation in a courtroom, we're gonna make progress, and we're gonna make progress in our direction because our arguments are more persuasive. The other side has nothing really. You can't justify abortion. They have nothing. Ours are more persuasive, and now the door is open for those arguments to take on front and center stage.
Yeah, Father, and that's as more people have these discussions around the kitchen table. I think of what a friend of mine said to me recently. I said, "When did you go from being, I'll let him have it, pro-choice, quote-unquote pro-choice, to pro-life?" And she said, "Well, it's when I thought about the issue for the first time, when I really thought about it, when I wasn't just mouthing things I had heard or I was indoctrinated to believe, when I wasn't just spouting the pieties of the spirit of the age. I just sat and I thought about it for like a minute. And I realized the first time I thought about it, I was like, huh, no way, that's wrong." And so now a lot of Americans, for the first time, because they're busy, right? They're busy. Our lives are just, we're inundated with. I did not know about abortion until my high school girl. I heard a joke freshman year in high school, the first time I heard the word abortion. A guy said, did you guys hear the new Planned Parenthood slogan? It's you blank them. It was, we pluck them, you blank them. That's their new slogan. Yeah. And I was like, what is that? What is he talking about? I was a freshman with some senior who said that. And then the next time I heard, I thought about abortion, when it struck me, was when I was at Fort Benning, Georgia, and my high school girlfriend called me, and her soul was crying, and her father said, "Your secret's gone." I took her to get an abortion. And it was as if they said, "We killed grandma for dinner, you know, on Thanksgiving." It's what we do in America when they hit 90. It was that bizarre, unthinkable, unimaginable. And I just thought about it. When was the first time you, as a young person, heard the word abortion and thought about it?
Me?
Yes, Father. Do you remember?
In church. Yeah, I remember hearing it in church, which, of course, many people would say, "Oh, I never hear about it in church." But I actually did, and I was a teenager, and the priest was saying about, you know, this is abortion. I guess it must have been right around when Roe came down, you know, and the priest was saying how this was not a good thing for our country. And I remember thinking, when I first heard that, it was like, I got to give that some thought. You know, like I didn't have like right away a pro-life or pro-abortion reaction either way. It was like, I got to think about that. You know, and I started thinking.
That's
about
interesting.
It.
So you didn't just say, "Okay, church says I believe." You said, "Okay, let me think about that." Whoa.
Yeah. It was more like, I got to think about this. And because I had, like you just said, I never thought about it before. And that's where, like I say, a few years after that, going to that March for Life, boy, that really sparked a flame in me. But it was, you know, consideration. It's like the first question is, you know, what is an abortion? And so many people think they have an opinion about it, but they end up talking past each other because one person in the conversation has in his mind, you know, a dismembered baby, and the other person in the same conversation has in their mind women's rights, women's health, women's advancement, women's equality, constitutional rights, freedom, and then, who's against those things? We're for those things. But they're talking about two different things.
Yeah, that's right. And then they just discount us as not caring about women. We discount them not valuing life. You know, you're a Catholic priest. You hear confessions. And another place where you've really been a pioneer is the post-abortive movement. You know, a lot of people who went to college with me or worked with me when I was in college or were in the Army with me, except from my closest friends or those who went to basic training with me who were there when I got the call, I never told my story I never shared it. The first time I shared it was at St. Jude Catholic Church in Hawaii. First time I shared it publicly in 1999. I was giving I was assistant director of Hawaii Right to Life. I was giving one of those old school pro-life talks. This is a sperm. This is an egg. This is fertilization. This is a fetal model. And when I showed the fetal model, a girl about 13, 14 years old, her hands went around her womb. She hugged herself and a tear came down her eye.
Oh.
And I had a weird thing that went through my head. I remember it like yesterday. She thinks I'm pointing a finger at her. And so I said out loud, and she had an abortion. I'm like, I can't believe this freshman or eighth grader had an abortion. And so I said out loud, I said, you know, guys, when we talk about it, when you point a finger, you point three fingers back at yourself. And I don't want you to think I'm pointing fingers at anyone who's ever had an abortion, because I am responsible for an abortion. And I told my story for the first time. And for the first time, I saw young people actually lean in and pay attention to my talk. And I saw the girl who was crying sit straight up, and her hands left her womb and went to her side. And as I shared about this, I realized I didn't feel it was my right to share the story, because it wasn't my story alone. And it was someone else's story in an even more intimate way, my high school girlfriend. So I felt like I felt guilty for years for sharing the story, until she asked me to continue to share the story. And you've met her, actually. Wow. I don't know if you remember. You met her. But then it was around that time, you may remember the year, but when I discovered the post-abortion movement and all of these women who were wounded by abortion. Do you want to share about that? I mean, I really believe that the abortion debate in America is a debate between, on both sides, between women wounded by abortion.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is a movement, like you said. That's a good way to put it. A whole movement of people who have been through this experience for themselves and have experienced its aftermath. Now, in the aftermath, some are suffering in silence. Some are suffering and don't even realize yet that the cause of their suffering is the abortion. Others have suffered and have come out of the silence, have sought help, have found healing, found forgiveness. And then a subset of those people have decided to share their stories about all this. So I'm privileged to be the pastoral director for Rachel's Vineyard, and it's a worldwide retreat program for healing after abortion. It's the largest such program. And it is using solid psychological research combined with the power of God's word and the sacraments. So there's that. And then out of those who come, we have the Silent No More campaign. So you've got this beautiful dynamic of the people who did just like you did, sharing their story. Why did I get an abortion? What was it like for me in the short term? What was it like in the long term? And then how did I find healing and forgiveness? People may ask, well, why would they want to share their story? Well, a couple of things happen. People who might be tempted to have an abortion get another thing to think about. Do I want to suffer as a result of this? I'm thinking of it as a solution. I'm thinking of it as a magic wand. But maybe it's not going to solve my problems. Maybe it's going to create more problems. And then those, of course, who hear these testimonies and they've been through it themselves, but maybe they're locked in that silence and that shame. Maybe they don't know that there's hope or healing. They get encouraged. They get encouraged to go look for the same kind of healing that this person who's giving the testimony is saying that they have. It's a beautiful movement. We give these people a chance to share their stories out at rallies, in interviews, and even some of them will go to legislative hearings, and their testimony will help the legislators pass some pro-life laws. We help people discern, because not all are called to do this, so we want to discern carefully with them if they are called. But it is a beautiful thing, and people can look at these testimonies. We have a whole collection of them online at abortiontestimonies.com.
Yeah, and what that movement has really helped me understand, as strange as it sounds, I was like a wrecking ball in the 90s as a young pro-lifer. I thought abortion was really rare. I mean, for young people, this was before the age of Google. I just never could imagine that I was surrounded by people that had abortions. So to me, yeah. it was as if this happened to me. It's a horrible thing, but I can never imagine my friend, my mother, my aunts, others were post-abortive, which is all true. I didn't imagine that. And so my words I didn't understand were like arrows in the hearts of so many people around me. I remember when I was doing a CNN interview on the street at the March for Life. It was when I was youth director for American Life League, and I was with Tina Whittington, and we were standing together. And now she's with Students for, you know, Tina, Students for Life of America.
Yeah.
And yes. I was doing an interview with CNN, and I used the language that I always use, which is I don't say abortion. I said, I'm here to stand up to protect children from the violence of abortion, da, 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 da. And with the language I was using, she said, can you please stop saying destroying an innocent child in the womb? Can we use the word abortion? I said, well, no, I don't use the word abortion. What I say is what it is. It's destroying a child in the womb. And she goes, okay, let's try this interview again. So she started interviewing me again, and she asked the question, and I said, well, I know I'm here to defend children from the violence, you know, from destruction. We destroy the most vulnerable members of the human family, the child and the womb. And when I said that, the reporter started crying. She said, I'm done. And she went and sat on the curb with the mic. This was a CNN reporter with the mic on the curb. And she was just standing there weeping.
Wow.
And I'm like, this woman's post-abortive. And so what the post-abortion healing movement has helped me understand is I assume, of course, when we're talking about abortion, at a family dinner or when I'm giving a speech at a pro-life pregnancy center banquet, I know that there's banquet waitresses that are listening and that my words can be like arrows. Yep. And so when I speak at these banquets, I speak with the banquet waitresses as my audience. And I'll never forget a time, Father, I was speaking at up to a group in Montana. It was like this huge tent. And there was this banquet waitress. She was tall. And as I was speaking, I don't know if you do this, Father. I know you speak a lot. I can kind of see everything and everybody. I'm feeling and seeing
them. Yeah, me too. Yeah.
And I see this young woman. She's beautiful, but her shoulders are hunched. Her back is, she's just like defeated. And as she's walking slower and slower each time I see her across from me, then she like disappeared. And I'm giving my speech, I'm searching for her because I wasn't naive. And then I realized she pulled up a chair and was sitting right in front of me, listening. And then after my speech, she was standing off to the side and waiting. Well, they were signing. I was signing autographs of Bella and of my book. And it was like an hour after the event that I'm signing autographs. She waited till, by God's grace, it was me and like three people left. And one of the three people was a Rachel's Vineyard representative. Just by coincidence. And this woman came up to me. She said, sir, I'm 22 years old. I'm from Utah. I was raised LDS. 17, I got pregnant and left home and went to Las Vegas and had an abortion. And I've been here. I worked in Vegas and then I ended up coming here. I have never felt relief from the pain since the abortion. Not for one second. And listening to your words was as if the pain was being pulled from my heart. And I just want to thank you. And then I was able to say, and then the woman stepped up and she said, I'm with Rachel's Vineyard, da da da, and here's my information. But I think that that's one thing Roe v. Wade has now overturned. But I think a lot of women may, as you said, were not aware that their pain was caused by their abortion. But how is Rachel's Vineyard, and I know you've been thinking about this, this decision is going to open up some fresh wounds that weren't healing properly to begin with, right?
Yes. Well, anytime abortion's in the headlines, that happens, you know, because one of the after effects of abortion, as you know, is that people just put it out of their heads. You know, how many people have come to us for healing and they've said, yo, Father, it's been 20 years. And, you know, the day of that abortion, you know, my boyfriend and I were driving away from the clinic and we didn't talk about it and we have never talked about it since, you know. And she may have, you know, just clammed up for decades, and then, you know, abortion comes into the headlines front and center, and it just by bringing it back into mind can lead her then on a path of having to face the conflicts within her, the feelings, not only the moms but the dads, and really we're talking about a cluster of people here too, the grandparents, the friends. I mean, if a mom can and a dad can grieve when they realize that they had their child killed, or how well developed that child was, or any of these other insights, so can the friend who helped pay for it, or who drove them there, or maybe who was the driving force behind the abortion in the first place, pushing them towards it. So a lot of grief, a lot of pain on the part of a lot of these concentric circles of relationships and people. So one thing that will happen as a result of this Dobbs case and all the attention on it is that. But there's another dynamic too that will happen, and that is a lot of these folks that have been suffering the pain of abortion will, especially those that have, you know, come through feeling, they'll be convinced by this, because they'll realize that many people will be spared the pain that they've had to deal with for decades. They'll be consoled that the laws will be getting passed to actually prohibit it and save people from, not only save the babies from death, but save those moms and other family members from pain. So there'll be a consoling effect. There'll be an effect of it'll be easier for us to get people's attention when we send out the word, inviting folks to healing, and because that's always a key mission that we're on, is to get the word out to more people that there is healing, and this is a moment when the voices of Silent No More need to be louder than ever and say, you know, to people, don't argue that this is a bad thing, this decision. Don't argue that, you know, women need abortion. We don't need abortion. In fact, it hurts us.
So where do we go from here, Father? So there's risk. What are the risks? So where do we go from here as a movement to defend the vulnerable from violence? And what are the risks we face? I mean, history, the ball's bounced in a lot of different ways. And there have been movements that have thought they've had a victory, but it's led to their ultimate defeat. So where do we go now as a movement? And what risks do we face? What opportunities are presenting themselves to us now?
Yeah, well, one of the risks is to sit back and think that the job is done, because really the work should intensify now. The way to deal with this moment is to amp up the effort. And the reason is because what the Supreme Court has done here is to open the door. They've said, basically, let's put it this way. People might not be thinking about it this way, but the Dobbs decision of the Supreme Court does not take a position on what abortion policy should be. And that may surprise some people, because it's being celebrated as a pro-life victory. It is, but not for the reasons people might think it is. It's not because the court is taking a pro-life position. The court is saying, we made a mistake in the past by taking a pro-abortion position. We made the mistake of telling the people of the United States and their elected lawmakers that they could not protect the unborn if they wanted to, at least before viability. And the justices said in this decision, you know, it's not our place to do that. Neither the Constitution nor anything in our history or tradition or the mandate of the court gives us the right or authority to say to the states, you cannot protect the unborn. We made a mistake. So now what we're saying is we're going to get out of the policymaking business on abortion, and we're leaving it to the states, to the people and their elected representatives. We should say not just the states, the Congress still has a role too. Now, having said all this, therefore, one of the risks is that people will think, oh, the court did it for us. The court gave us a victory. Well, they gave you a victory by giving you an opportunity. You now have the open door to press forward with laws, policies passed through the law, not imposed by unelected judges, and now you've got to do it. So this moment is given to us. We have to do it. We have the more persuasive arguments of the other side. It's going to be harder for them, because now they have to make their case instead of hiding behind the justices. Oh, constitutional right to abortion. So now they have to make their case, and they don't have anywhere near as persuasive a case as we do. In fact, I would say they don't have a case at all. You can't justify the killing of babies. It's a great opportunity, therefore. Let's not be complacent. Let's celebrate this moment, this mid-course correction, if you will, by the court. But let's make sure that we're getting to know our state legislators. I've been telling people to that that's one of the next practical things to do. They are the ones who can do more now than they could before, protecting the unborn. Talk with your state legislators. What kind of pro-life laws should be passed in your state? What opportunities are there? What is their position on this issue? Let them know what your position is. That's one of the real concrete next steps that can be taken. Jason, you know, a lot of the work of the pro-life movement is going to remain exactly the same. When you think about the educational work that we do day by day, that doesn't change. The electing pro-life candidates, of course, the work of lobbying. I mean, if anything, what changes is that the same work that we've been doing all these years, as we continue doing it, it ends up having more effect. Because, again, these policies don't get blocked by the courts. They're actually going to go through, and they're going to go into effect. So stay the course. People need to stay the course, increase the intensity of the work, and be ready to, well, as we always have been ready, to serve the needs of the women who need alternatives to abortion.
You know, Father, you just gave me, I don't know if you've written an article on this or not, but you gave me the title of this episode, which is Opening the Door. The Supreme Court opens the door to a culture of life. Will we walk
there
through it with Father Frank Pavone? But that metaphor is really it. The door is open. We haven't walked through it yet. The door's just been opened. Well, now we've got to walk through the door. And walking through the door is going to take fortitude and discipline. But that's it. As we talk about opening the door to a culture of life, I was a rabid anti-Catholic. I was not only an atheist. Do you know, Father, when I graduated college, I wrote my three goals in life, which was to end abortion, was one of my goals. Another one of my goals was to, my goals were end abortion, develop an atheist anthropology to support human dignity, and because I was a Randian and I felt her anthropology was weak, and to destroy the Catholic Church. These were my goals.
Oh, yeah.
And so why was I so anti-Catholic? Which might strike you as strange. It strikes a lot of people as strange. I was repulsed by the seamless garment. Now, a lot of Catholics think I'm a seamless garment Catholic. I've been invited to speak at groups that were horrified when they heard my talk. Because I do work on immigration, on standing up when there's genocide, democide, and total war. And so they mistakenly think that I am a quote-unquote seamless garment Catholic. And what repulsed me so much about the consistent ethic as it was presented, as I saw it at the time by Cardinal Bernardine, was they compared the destruction of the child in the womb to completely unlike and incommensurate issues like, for example, what minimum wage should be, or should there not be midnight basketball, or all of these sorts of things. I'm like, you are going to compare destroying a child to all an endless ocean of prudential issues. But there are like incommensurate issues to abortion. Sadly enough, our economy being coupled to the CCP, which is an economy based on slavery and forced abortion. How will Roe v. Wade, are there other issues, or where will we go as a movement? If we are to go through that door that the Supreme Court has opened into a culture of life, there are issues. There is an authentic, consistent ethic. I would say that our open borders, seeing these migrants that were being shuttled into a country, so they can be exploited, is a like and commensurate issue to abortion. And I don't want to get you in trouble, but like the USCCB advocates open borders, and the language they use is the same language that is used to say abortion is good for women, but it hurts women and exploits women. Our open borders exploits migrants, and it leads to migrants dying, like which just happened. The numbers keep climbing, how many migrants that were probably Catholic and they were praying the rosary and begging Our Lady for help as they were dying in the backs of these trucks. Yeah. So how will we see, if we have the courage to walk through these doors, can we see, and maybe this is a leading question because I'm the founder of the Whole Life Movement, but will we see a flourishing of life in other ways now that Dobbs, because of Dobbs?
Well, you know, this goes to the question that you and I have faced for so many years, people asking us, oh, you know, why do you think abortion is the only issue? And of course, we've already responded to them. We know it's not the only issue. But the right to life is the core of every issue. And this is why abortion has justifiably received urgent priority attention. Because unless we can acknowledge that there's a right to life that the government can't touch and that people must reverence and protect, that takes the heart. If we attack that, and that's what abortion does more directly than other issues, most other issues, it is directly attacking the right to life. It's saying it's not there. It's saying if a court decides to take away this protection just because someone's alive, that it can do so. Well, you know, John Paul II said what that does is that kills true freedom. And he says the deterioration of the state that allows abortion, the deterioration of the state itself has begun. So, okay, the heart and core of every issue has been now destroyed by abortion. Why is poverty an issue? Well, the poor have...
I love that, Father. Abortion's selfish. Not the only issue, but it's the heart and core of every issue is the sanctity of life.
Yes, exactly. So you destroy that and you've taken away the foundation for your other efforts on behalf of justice, equality, and human rights. So will then the Dobbs decision help the other issues? Absolutely. In as much as, again, what the court is doing here is backing away from a previously held pro-abortion position, and it's saying, wait a second, why can't the people protect life if they so choose? Now, there's another position the court could take further down the road, which is to say, not only are we not depriving the states of the right to protect these children, but we are recognizing that these lives must be protected. That's further down the road. That's a decision
which is in the 14th Amendment, right? Which the amendment that the court found the right to abortion is actually where you will find the right to life.
That's right. This is the ironic thing, isn't it? That the other side, you know, to this day, they'll keep invoking the 14th Amendment.
Keep invoking it, because there's going to come a day they regret invoking it.
That's right, because it says no person may be deprived of, well, before it gets to liberty, it says life. So it's like, it's so ironic that this very same amendment, it says you can't be deprived of life without due process of law. And then it says liberty, so they say, oh, can't be deprived of liberty, so therefore we can take life. It doesn't, it's inherently contradictory, and it is just an abuse of the Constitution. But the point here, relevant to, you know, like, what is this going to do for these other issues? You know, like we've always said, if we can't get this right, if we can't recognize that we have to secure the right to life, well, then, you know, we're not going to make progress on any of these other issues, because it all depends on the right to life. That's why an issue is an issue in the first place. You know, why is national security important? Why is border security important? Because life has to be protected. And why is unemployment, health care, poverty, why are these issues? Because life is at stake. That's always why an issue is an issue. Human trafficking, terrible exploitation of human rights, all these abuses. It's all because life matters. So what resolving the abortion issue does is it brings us right to that core. And if we can begin to turn around on that, we're going to be reinforcing the very foundation of all these other issues.
Father, you'll appreciate this. You know, my organization is the last and only organization that we know of operating in Afghanistan right now. We have a network of safe houses across Afghanistan and Pakistan. We fed hundreds of thousands of people through the winter. We have thousands in our safe houses. One of the men in our safe houses worked for an NGO that was promoting an Afghan man who worked for an NGO that was promoting abortion, pushing for abortion in Afghanistan. And, well, of course, when Afghanistan fell, this guy became a prime target. And he had heard we were rescuing human rights workers that worked for Western NGOs.
Yeah.
He approached us to rescue him. And I have to say my first response to him was, why don't you go to your former employer and ask for their help? And they sent him a form letter basically saying, you're on your own. Your employment with us is terminated and we have no responsibility for whatever happens to you.
Yeah.
And we moved him to a safe house. And I explained to him that you were abandoned because of the logic of abortion. When you were useful and there were federal funds and found massive foundation funds associated with funding your project, your program, your American partners were with you. When there was no utility to be had and nothing but sacrifice and risk, it was pro-lifers that saved your life. And I want you never to forget that.
Yeah.
And he wrote me a letter saying that he's going to fight for life, all life, when we get him eventually to safety. It was funny, John Smirak, our mutual friend, when I told him that, he got mad at me. He goes, you should have sent him some morning after pills and told him to keep Godspeed. And he was kidding, of course. But right, that is the logic. I say only a president, a pro-abortion president, would have abandoned Afghanistan the way Biden did. The catastrophe in Afghanistan, the catastrophe with Obama sitting on his hands when ISIS was raging and genocides were happening, it's the logic of abortion. Of course, Trump comes in within 72 days, ISIS is subdued. It's the logic of abortion has worked its way in a really awful way into our foreign policy.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. I don't think these men themselves even recognize it. And this is what, you know, our bishops have said this, and really many, many pro-life leaders of all backgrounds have said this, the corrosive effect that Roe v. Wade has had on our culture, because even to the highest levels, because it is saying to us sometimes it's okay to just throw innocent human life away. Even these terrible acts of violence, students shooting students, young people killing young people with guns, and it's like, wait a minute, maybe children are killing children because parents are killing children. We've taught them that somehow it's okay. Not in so many words, but they don't need words. They see us doing it, and they're absorbing it. They're learning it. This has got to be brought to light. These are profound concerns that at some point we've got to put these dots together and realize the truth of that. I mean, why would you have these open border policies and, you know, bringing these violent criminals into the country? Meanwhile, President Trump was getting them out of the country. These violent gangs and everything. And it's like, doesn't it all hold together? It's either respect for human life or it's not.
There's an authentic seamless garment. There's an authentic consistent ethic. And that's why, you know, the pro-life movement has taught me how to persevere, how to fight for those who offer no utility, who can never know you or thank you. And so this is why I'm so thrilled. I'm so, like you said, I'm beside me. It hasn't even struck me. My wife was crying all day on Friday and Saturday. Yeah. And she looked at me. She's like, what's wrong with you? Don't you get what's happening? And I said, I don't know. I'm numb. And I still think I'm kind of like, I don't know.
And you know what? I'm feeling the same thing. I'm feeling like my mind, emotions, and body still have to catch up with the reality of what just happened. And you know, I was saying over recent months, you know, I said, really looks like the court is going to reverse Roe, and I was confident that they would. But I also said to people, you know, this leaked draft has given us a little bit of a foretaste of the, you know, the joy and the excitement. I said, but we really don't know how we're going to feel when this actually happens. And that was true, because it's a surreal experience.
And, you know, and maybe it's as you said, Father, we understand. And I want people to, when I see pro-life leaders or others saying, this isn't a big deal, why are we celebrating? No.
Oh.
This is a big deal. We need to celebrate. But I think maybe for those of us activists on the front line, we realize, okay, the door is open. Here we go again. Now we have to walk through this door.
Well,
we're not in the culture of life yet. We got to walk through the door.
Well, you know, the hard work is always going to be there. Let's put this in perspective another way. Let's say we reached the day, and we will reach it someday, where every baby, maybe by a constitutional amendment, because that ultimately is our goal when it comes to public policy. We want a constitutional amendment that says what you were pointing out before. The 14th Amendment, protection of life, includes the unborn. you know, and there can be debates about what the exact wording should be. But that ultimately, let's say we got to the day where, okay, that's it, friends. Abortion is unconstitutional. Every baby is now protected. Even then, the work would still be in front of us, because pregnant moms are always going to be there to help. Some of them are always going to be afraid. Some of them are there's always going to be situations where they feel they can't care for that baby. There's always going to be healing to be done from the wounds of abortion. And there's always going to be need for vigilance, because no matter how many victories one gets in public policy, you know, our system can backslide. And the other big area, we haven't been discussing this here in this program, but we've got to keep an eye on enforcement, because there is a good number of you know, pro-abortion folks in the positions of prosecutors, district attorneys, attorneys general. Some Democrats who are running for some of these positions are even saying, they're boasting, oh, well, I'm not going to enforce any pro-life laws. No. Well, then maybe you should resign your position, because, you know, if your job requires it, you got to do your job. So we have to keep an eye on enforcement. So we're always going to have to be vigilant. The work is always going to be there to do. But when we reach these milestone victories, we owe it to ourselves to, you know, really to celebrate it. And to, because the celebration itself will give us the strength then to do the work of the next phase.
Yeah, and even once life is protected in the womb, we'll have transhumanism, and our posterity will be battling all sorts of new, unimaginable threats to human dignity.
That's right.
And exactly. They will look to us, yeah. They will look to the pro-life movement the way we look to the civil rights movement, and we look to the abolitionists, and there'll probably be a king in that movement too. Alveda King works with you, and there'll probably be a king in that movement battling transhumanism and its implications 100 years from now. Father, we only have just two minutes. Is there anything that I didn't ask you that you, there's just so much I want to ask you. I could interview you for 10 hours. Is there anything I didn't bring up that you want to share?
Well, I just want to encourage people, get involved in the movement. Maybe for some listeners, this is the first time they're really taking a deep look at abortion. And we just want you to know you're welcome in this movement. You're needed in this movement. Doesn't matter what your skill set is. Every skill set is needed. Because the defense of life has so many different dimensions. You know, maybe you're a plumber or a computer technician who can help a pregnancy center operate and save lives. Maybe you fix roofs, you know, and the pregnancy centers or the pro-life organizations need your help doing that. It doesn't matter what your background is. You want to help save babies, there's a way to help save them. I just want to encourage everybody to do exactly that and encourage pro-life wherever you see it. Jason, you and I know folks and have friends that are, you know, in the Democrat Party, you know, or they're in the progressive movement, or they're in some other sector of society that overall may not be pro-life, but they themselves are. We always want to encourage people, wherever they might be, to persevere in this greatest of all human rights causes. Yeah. So thanks, Jason. I think this is a great idea that you're doing these programs.
Well, Father, and I should have shared this with you before the show. Our audience is, we have more people listening outside of the United States than in the United States. It's across the Middle East and in Africa because of a lot of the work that we do. And my goal is to bring vulnerable communities together like strings, and we wind them together to be unbreakable. And so we have right now, I always get emails from folks, Afghans that are listening in safe houses in Pakistan, Uyghur who are listening in Denmark. And so we have a very broad and diverse audience across the world, but I'm always getting emails from them saying, I want to join you in the fight to defend children from the violence of abortion.
That is beautiful. We want them. We value them. And I'm privileged to speak with them, our friends from all around the world. We're all in this together because it's about human life itself.
All right, Father, give us one action item. Where do you want us to go, and what do you want us to do?
You know what? I want to give you this website, lookatabortion.org. You know, you and I have talked many times about the importance of doing that. And I would say to everybody all around the world, you're talking to somebody, you think they have an opinion about abortion. Listen, abortion looks the same all around the world. Take a look at it. Challenge them to look at it. Lookatabortion.org.
All right, Father. From Waikiki Beach, aloha. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Aloha.
We were so privileged to listen to Father Frank Pavone. He's one of the most sought after men in the world right now for interviews. And look at abortion. I'm going to put the website in the show notes. It's something we need to do, especially those of you outside the United States. This debate, what's great about the overturning of Roe v. Wade is the abortion debate is now raging around the world. In France, they're shocked and horrified. In France, they have much stricter restrictions on abortion than we do in the United States, even with the overturning of Roe versus Wade. So now is a real opportunity for us to have a global conversation because ideologies of evil do not respect borders. And the culture of death is a menace, and it is a menace around the world, pushing into Africa, pushing across Central and South America, pushing into the Middle East. And so could you imagine having a world order grounded on a respect for the incomparable dignity and beauty of the human person? And that is why I have this show. And by the way, speaking of the show, this show, you know how we're going to celebrate? This is how I need you to celebrate our victory. Treat yourself to a MyPillow. So go to MyPillow.com, get yourself the best pillow in the world. And if you use the code Jones, you get a deep, deep discount. What a better way to celebrate this victory than with a new pillow from MyPillow, because I think that's the only company that I know of, massive corporation, that is bravely standing for life. So go to MyPillow.com, use the code Jones, and then go over to iReadEpoch.com and use the code Jason Jones to get your subscription to the best newspaper in the world, Epoch Times. It is the first place I go every morning, and it is the first place you should go to. And of course, this episode, as always, is being brought to you by the Vulnerable People Project, standing in solidarity with the most vulnerable people in the world when it is most challenging. Go to thegreatcampaign.org and join the team. Until next time, it's the Jason Jones Show. And by next time, I mean tomorrow. Aloha.
This has been the Jason Jones Show, powered by Mudhouse Media.